Or now, they'll get a 5-point bonus. If you want to wait till Thursday, then you won't have the 5 points.
So 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, right?
If not Thursday, it's a deadline. Okay? Yeah, I'll put it back. Yes, next week, some of the dirty data, I'll put it on the website. So check the website. Especially when you can assess work at the last minute, you think the people do, you might want to look at the website in case it gets pushed.
Are we getting some, was that true?
Yes, that was part of the confusion. I thought it was going to be here right now, but I let them have vision all downstairs. And again, Joseph, it's not that strange, it's that very, it's nearly a crime. Okay, today we have the pleasure of having Ale Aspect, who's going to talk to us about experimental realization of belly bodies. I think when people started to think about interpretation of quantum mechanics and philosophy and implications of quantum mechanics, a lot of this was really encapsulated in lots of words, and there's always fight about words. And then you can agree or disagree about the definition of what these words mean. But when we have an equation, and there's an inequality, and we do an experiment, and we see violation or not violation of this inequality, then this makes a test, which is, still people will complain about all the details here and there, but at least it kind of makes the mind focused on the importance of the difference between certain ways of looking at nature around us. And this is really the essence of what we're going to look at here today.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Okay, I'm not sure of what is the rule of the game. So probably I'm going to set the rule of the game myself. Because I received message of Joseph saying I should focus on the equation of loopholes and things like that. But well, even if you know a lot about Bell's inequalities, probably you don't have yet heard me explaining that. So today, basically, I will explain you how I understood Bell's paper when I read it exactly 30 years ago. 30 years ago, somebody gave me this paper from John Bell. I read this paper, and after 1 hour, I decided that I would spend years of my life working on that. It is true. It is a true story. And I think that, well, how many of you have read the paper by John Bell? Wonderful. Okay, so excellent. So I'm going to tell you how I did understand this this paper and how it stimulated the experiment we have done. And maybe on Thursday, we will more talk about the so-called inefficiency loophole and this kind of thing. Today, I want to have a broader perspective. Before starting explaining everything about Bell's theorem and Bell's inequality, I would like to put it in a more general framework. And this general framework, I have sketched it and developed it in the recent years when the people of Cambridge University Press wanted to reedit the book, to edit the second edition of Speakable and Unspeakable. You know this book. And they asked me to write an introduction to this book. And at the beginning, you know, I thought, I started writing a text as everybody is saying, John Bell was a great man, blah, blah, blah. And after a while, I say, this is a unique opportunity to think back, and I like very much history of science. and to think how I view the evolution of quantum physics in the 20th century and where John Bell stands among that. And by thinking and by talking to many physicists, and one of them with whom I have talked a lot is Bill Phillips, you know, he got the Nobel Prize for laser cooling, and he's a good friend. We talk a lot about that. And I came with this general scheme that I want to evoke to you. You may disagree, but at least, and I will be happy to hear disagreement or comments or things like that. My scheme is the following. In fact, we had, everybody knows that we have a quantum revolution starting in 1900 or 1905. I think it's more fair to say that it is Einstein who really started the quantum revolution. Okay, but let's say that it is flat, okay? And this quantum revolution was both conceptual and technological. And to make a long story short, but if you read this text, you will see that it's a long story. I think that the conceptual revolution under the first quantum revolution is wave particle duality. You can say many different words, but it amounts to being wave particle duality, theory. And this, of course, has allowed physicists to understand fantastic things. I'm sure many of you know, but it's always good to say it again, that classical physics, elaborated as it was, could not explain the stability of matter. Okay, you all know that. Positive and negative charge attract each other and they will radiate and it will collapse. Okay? And you needed quantum mechanics and wave particle duality to understand the stability of matter. How does it work? If you try to squeeze a wave in a smaller and smaller volume, the wavelength has to be smaller and smaller. And if the wavelength is smaller and smaller, the energy is bigger and bigger, and it is this trade-off between the two things that makes that there is a minimum volume to confine an electron and a nucleus, okay? And of course, the physicists could understand solid-state physics and many fantastic things, including exotic things like superfluidium, etc., etc. All this is a conceptual part of the first quantum revolution. And we all know that this first quantum revolution, after clarifying the concepts, after understanding matter, led to a fantastic technological revolution that has changed the society, certainly as much as the industrial revolution, and so the steam engine changed the society in the 18th and 19th century. Okay? And these are named Society of Information, or Information-Based Society, with the invention of transistor and of laser. And for these two things, you have to be fully aware that it's not a guy in his garage who made these inventions. These were Nobel winners. I mean, people who have been thinking for decades about how does the current passes in a solid, etc. They invented the transistor, and for laser also with the same scientists. Okay. And these are the root of the information-based society. Of course, this you know, but it's good from time to time to have a perspective. It's absolutely extraordinary, the change it has produced. And again, the two sides, conceptual and technological. My claim, by thinking to the role of John Bell, okay, my claim is that a new quantum revolution starts, let's say, in the 60s, in the 1960s. And for this, there are two ingredients. Of course, entanglement and John Bell, but this one maybe you have not thought of. So let us take a few minutes to think. I think that it is really in the decades between 1960 and 1980 that because experimentalists were able to isolate and manipulate single microscopic objects, for instance, you know, you have heard of Dennett, okay? Dennett could trap a single electron, keep it for hours, make measurements on a single electron, okay? Then people were able to trap a single ion. With a single ion, they were able to observe quantum jumps. Quantum jumps has been a subject of debate for decades. I remember very clearly in 1980, there were still excellent physicists, I mean not wrong physicists, good physicists who claim that quantum jumps are just a fiction for lectures, but it doesn't exist in real world.
I want to explain what are quantum jumps, because we have a few computer science people here.
So you want to know what is a quantum jump?
A quantum jump. Anybody knows what quantum?
Do you want to know? Well, let's make a poll. Do you want to know what is a quantum jump? Okay, let's. You have an ion basically it's an atom, but because it has a charge, you can trap it. So they were able to trap a single ion. And in this single ion, you have three levels, a ground level, well, you have more, but you consider a scheme where you have a ground level, you have an excited level, and a strong transition. By strong, I mean I can shine a laser and it will scatter one photon every, I don't know, 10 nanoseconds or something like that. You can see it basically with the naked eye, okay? But then there is also a very weak transition. And this weak transition here, you have a lifetime tau maybe 1 second, let's say, something like that. It's a highly suppressed transition, okay? So if you put the atom here, then the time for decay is a few seconds, maybe 10 seconds, something like that. And you can also shine a laser on this transition. And what you observe is that if you look at the intensity of the light from the strong transition, and you plot it as a function of time, here, you will see it shines, and suddenly, woof, goes to zero for a certain time, and then goes again, and then goes to zero. So what you see the atom jumping from here to there. It's a single quantum object, and you see the quantum jump. And why was it a big debate? It was a big debate because you can do a single calculation in quantum mechanics of what is the probability of having the atom here, and what is the probability of having the atom here, okay? And many people thought for a very long time that quantum mechanics is only good for this kind of thing. And so their claim was the following. If I have an immense ensemble, 10 to the 23, okay, atoms like that, I have a vapor, then these probabilities that I have found is nice, because certain of the atoms are shining light, others are not shining, and the density matrix or whatever standard calculation of quantum mechanics can give you the average. But these people were saying, you cannot know more. Quantum mechanics is not good for making prediction on a single object. In fact, other people disagree with that, and the standard method of quantum mechanics allow you to calculate this. And the rule of the game is the following. What you have to calculate is not the average value of the intensity which is emitted. You have to calculate the correlation function, that is to say something which classically I write in the following way, I of t, I of t plus tau. Or, if you prefer to have it in terms of probability, you want to calculate the probability to observe something at time t plus tau and at time t. And you see now that if you have quantum jumps like that, if you have a scheme like that, on this function, which is something like the delay function, I have not look into my lecture for some time, so I'm improvising. But the basic idea is that by looking at the probability to have light now and to have light a little later, this function will reveal the existence of this quantum jump. So, in fact, although you are looking at a single object, the statistical methods of quantum mechanics allow you to tell something statistically, although it is on a single object. But you have to go to more sophisticated quantities, which is this correlation function, this higher order correlation function. Okay? Now, having said so, people began to clarify the way in which quantum mechanics can be applied to single objects. And basically, there are two kinds of methods. There is this method, which is still calculating probabilities and average values, but probability and average value for more complicated objects, like a correlation function. And there is a second method, which has been developed in these years, that is to say in the 1980s. This is so-called quantum Monte Carlo. The quantum Monte Carlo is a method which allows you to simulate a possible evolution of your system. That is to say, you are using a non-Hermitian, Hamiltonian, etc., etc., and you can run a program at which, at any step in the program, so time is going on, okay, and at any step of the time, you have a random generator which makes a decision, do I stay here or do I go down? And at each step, it's quantum mechanics which allows you to calculate this probability. And you will generate one possible history for the system. And you will do it again and do it again for, let's say, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 possible histories. And then, so you imagine you have possible histories like that. And then you can make cuts at any time. And then you will recover the prediction of the density matrix. This is the second method. And really, I have lived in this period, and I was working at that time with Claude Cohen-Tanouji and Jean Dalibard. We were meeting every day and discussing all these things. And I think it was a real conceptual journey, very important. Now, of course, I'm going to talk today about entanglement. And of course, the second ingredient for this second quantum revolution is entanglement. But I claim that it's not only entanglement. And if you think to it, I can anticipate, because you know what I'm going to talk about. You could not observe entanglement if you had not been able to isolate pairs of photons. The key of observing entanglement is to have isolation in time. I have a given pair of photons, and then I can observe entanglement. If there were so many pairs together that I cannot separate in time the successive pairs, I would not be able to observe entanglement. So for me, really, the second quantum revolution is these two ingredients. Quantum mechanics applied to single object and entanglement recognized as different and extraordinary quantum property. And I strongly insist this is not at all the same as wave particle duality. And if you want a proof of that and of the fact that it was important to recognize it, read Lectures of Physics of Feynman, the old book that was released in the 1960s. There is a paragraph on EPR. And in that paragraph, Feynman said, EPR is not a problem. There is no paradox. And at another page, he says, wave-particle duality is all the mystery of quantum mechanics. There is no more mystery than wave-particle duality. 20 years later, in 1983, there is a wonderful paper by Feynman. It is a paper in which he introduces the concept of quantum computing. But if you read carefully this paper, there is a full paragraph in which Feynman derives Bell's inequality. He does not quote Bell, because he's Feynman. When Feynman derives something for himself, he does not quote other people. Probably, no, but because he certainly did not read the paper by Bell. He developed this and derived it for himself, and then he doesn't feel the necessity to quote other people. But okay, that's Feynman. We don't argue about that. But the point is that in that paper, 20 years later, in that paper, in 1983, Feynman writes a sentence like, I don't know the exact words, I can find it for you, but the sentence is something like, it may look ridiculous that the problem is squeezed to a question that one thing is bigger or smaller than another one. But there you are, it is bigger and is a big problem. So, in 1980-something, Feynman recognized that there was something else than wave particle duality in the mystery of quantum mechanics. So I would like, it took me time to elaborate all that, so I would like to share this with you. You may disagree, you may have another perception of the history of quantum mechanics, but I thought for more than 1 year before writing these things. And of course, at this point, because we all like symmetries, you can raise the question, does this new conceptual quantum revolution will entail a new technological revolution? You hope so, right? Okay. After this long introduction, but we have plenty of time, I'm supposed to stop after 1 hour and 30, or should I stop earlier and let questions, or how does it work? You can feel comfortable. You can stop me and ask questions. What is the normal schedule? They should go at 3:45?
Yeah, around 3:45. Usually we have questions. The stragglers stay there and ask more questions. Roughly around 3:45. Is there anybody who has a course at 4 at the back of the university?
But there will be another session on Thursday, okay? So so we will see how it goes. Okay, the last point I want to make is that I've decided recently, you see it's year 2004, to put on quant fields. In fact, it's my proceedings of the various conferences I give on Bell's inequality. And in fact, it started with the first version of that started 20 years ago, and you can find it, it's proceedings of the International Conference on Atomic Physics in Gothenburg. And then, of course, year after year, I add references, I change them. And suddenly I realized that you are perfectly allowed to put a paper on archive. It doesn't need to be published in a journal. They are perfectly happy if you send them a paper. So, in fact, this paper is on the archive, and from time to time I go into it and I will change the reference and something like that. So if you want to know my view on Bell's inequality, you find it. So we are going to talk about EPR correlation, Bell's theorem, and experimental tests, and we will see how it works. So you all know, of course, well, I need to interview you. What do you know about the original EPR paper? Did you study it or not? Yes? You look at it. How long?
We went into it, we derived it on the last assignment.
Yeah. You
derived it on the last assignment,
yeah. Okay. So, do you agree that at the end of the day, the question which is raised by this paper, and not only by this paper, in fact, there are many texts of Einstein. You know that Einstein argued with Bohr almost all his life, okay? From 1935, no, this is serious. From 1935 to the end of the life of Einstein and Bohr, which they died 1 year difference or something like that, they argued all the time together. So you have plenty of texts, like for instance in Einstein, Philosopher, Scientist, etc. So you can read really the bottom line. And it seems clear to me that the bottom line is the following. Quantum mechanics made probabilistic prediction, and of course, a natural thinking is to say, well, a theory that makes probabilistic prediction is a theory which is not complete. There is an underlying level, we know, of course, Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. In fact, we have no doubt that there are molecules with a given velocity, but it is convenient to have a statistical description. And the idea was, isn't it the case with quantum mechanics? Quantum mechanics would be a kind of statistical theory for an underlying level. That was the idea of Einstein, but with the Einstein-Tolosky was an argument. Einstein thought he had demonstrated the necessity to introduce an underlying level. Okay? And if you have studied it, I will not present it as the initial paper by Einstein. I will present it in a different way, which is closer to the way John Dale describes it. You know also that Niels Bohr immediately published a paper. Have you read the answer of Niels Bohr? Well, you should. You have Prola, okay? On Prola, you have the EPR paper, but next month, just 1 month later, Bohr writes a long answer. And, I have a big admiration for Bohr, but anyway, if you read the paper of Bohr, you will certainly agree that Bohr knew what he meant when he said that clarity and truth are complementary variables. Read the paper of Bohr and you will see. Anyway, the important point is that Bohr immediately realized that the attack was extremely serious. This is the important point. I think Bohr really was a genius, because I've read many reactions to the paper by EPR. Most of the reactions were, well, this is not important, well, Einstein doesn't know quantum mechanics, he doesn't know what he's saying. Not really. There are many papers like that. And Bohr took very seriously the paper of Einstein, and they argued for 20 years from that, and Bohr tried to argue. He understood that it was an extremely important process. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you how I'm convinced that when you observe EPR correlation, that is to say the correlation coming from environment, then if the world was not so crazy, we should have hidden variables. And I will not make the same reasoning as Einstein, I will rather make the same reasoning as John Depp, okay? So of course you all know the basic scheme. Here you have a source emitting a pair of photons, one goes to the left, one goes to the right. There is an equation of indistinguishability, this one is red, this one is blue, okay? You can put filters, you know exactly which one is going which direction. Here you have a polarizer, you know what is a polarizer? You know what is a polarizer? Yes, okay. So, who doesn't know what is a polarizer? You can raise. In fact, I have a small toy in my luggage. I forgot to bring it, but I can bring it on Thursday to make an experiment. No, does anybody? Is there anybody who does not know what is a polarizer? Okay, fine. Wonderful. So this is a polarizer with two channels. Okay, that is to say, you put it in orientation A, and then if the polarization is like that, light will go in the plus one channel. If the polarization is orthogonal to A, it will go in the minus one channel. If I have a macroscopic beam at a certain angle, it will be a fraction going up and a fraction going down. But if it is a single photon cannot be split, and then either it goes up or it goes down with a certain probability here. So this is making a measurement. The other one is also making a measurement of the polarization of photon mu2, and you can make an orientation defined by the quantity B. So at this point there is no EPR at all. The important thing is that I can put photon detectors here, and here, and here, and here, and with these photon detectors I can measure two things. I can measure single probabilities, that is to say probability to find plus one here when the polarizer is in orientation A, or probability to find minus one, etc., etc. But more important, and this is related to here, the interesting quantity is a joint probability, for instance, joint probability to observe plus one here and plus one here, or the joint probability to observe plus one here and minus one here in orientation A and B. So this is what I can learn. At this point, it's just a classical description. Now, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen discovered that quantum mechanics allows state of this kind. That is to say, state that you cannot factorize. This is a big discovery. Schrödinger discovery about at the same time. But it's really Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen who recognized immediately that this was like nothing else. Okay? So you all understand that what is amazing with this state is that it cannot be factorized. if you can produce a pair of photons with a polarization described at this state, then it's not very difficult to calculate the various probability predicted by quantum mechanics. You have done this calculation? Have you done it? Okay. So you know perfectly well as to find this, the joint probability P plus plus in orientation A and B give 1/2 of cosine to the square of the angle between the two detectors. This is clear for you? Okay. And you know also how to find the single probability P plus P minus equal 1/2. Okay. Now, the very important thing that Einstein, Polovsky, and Rosen recognize is the fact that as soon as you have probabilities like that, this means that you have very strong correlation between the two ends of the experiment. For instance, let's take the case where the two polarizers are parallel, so the angle is zero. Then you see immediately P plus plus equal P minus minus equal 1/2. If you remember that P plus is also equal to 1/2, then you immediately see that the conditional probability to find plus 1 here, if you have found plus 1 here, this conditional probability is 100%. Because conditional probability is the ratio of the joint probability divided by the probability of the first conditioning event. Okay? So there is a complete correlation between the two ends in this situation. Okay, I think there was. Okay. Let's elaborate a little bit on that. So you see the picture is the following. Here, if I have plus 1 here, I am sure to have plus 1 here. If I have minus 1 here, I am sure to have minus 1 here. Okay? So, and if you are not fully convinced, with the angle equal 0, the sign is 0, so you see that the crossed joint probability are 0, which means if you have plus 1 here, you are sure not to have minus 1 here. This has to be absolutely clear. Okay. Technically, you all know that, and this again, there is no quantum mechanics in what I am going to say now. On one side, I have a random variable, plus 1, minus 1. On the other side, I have a random variable, plus 1, minus 1. It's just like tossing a coin. Okay? There is no quantum mechanics. It looks random, but I observe there are correlations. For instance, suppose there is one guy here throwing a coin, and when he has heads, the other one here has heads. When he has tail, the other one has tail. How can I define classically the correlation by the so-called correlation coefficient, which is average of the product minus the product of the average, and you normalize. And when you apply this definition with quantities with value plus 1 or minus 1, it's very easy to show that this definition comes to sum of the probability of similar results minus sum of probability with different results. Okay? And so it should be clear that if P plus plus and P minus minus have a value 1/2 and 1/2 and this one are 0, then the coefficient is 1. So 100% correlation. Okay. So what I have done here, you must be aware, this definition is good for any random phenomenon. It's purely classical. Now, into this definition, I plug the quantum mechanical calculation, which were on the previous transparency. I put them here, and then I get this prediction of quantum mechanics for the classical coefficient of correlation. You have to be very clear in your mind. Okay. So I have strong correlations. Well, should I jump and say, miracle, miracle, there are correlations? The answer is evidently not. I shouldn't. I'm going to show you a very strange correlation. Look at my finger here. When I'm going to push here on that button, okay, something will happen on the screen. There is a strong correlation. between the motion of my finger and the fact that there is a green spot that you can see with your eyes and realize it with your brain. So, why do I say that? It's just to insist that having correlation has nothing mysterious. I chose decades ago to become a physicist because I'm deeply convinced that when we observe correlation in the world, there should be a way to understand this correlation. I think that correlation doesn't happen like that because God is great or I don't know. Correlation happens because nature can be understood. And the role of physics is to help us to understand nature. So we want to understand correlation. How do we do to understand correlation? Well, usually when we are professional physicists, the first way to understand correlation is to find the theory, write equation, and if the equation predicts the correlation I observe, I say, well, this theory is a good theory for understanding the correlation. Some people are satisfied with that. I'm not fully satisfied with it. I'm happy, of course, that there is a theory. And here we have a theory. Quantum mechanics has allowed us to predict certain correlation. Okay? But I'm not fully happy with that because I'm a naive physicist, and I like not only to have equations, but I also like to have images in my mind, to have pictures, because my intuition can only be stimulated by images, okay? So I like to find image to reflect the equations. So can I make image for understanding this EPR correlation that I have been able to calculate, that you are able to calculate? And now the real stuff is going to happen. Probably that you have understood that if you have a problem on EPR and you want to calculate this joint probability, the fast way of calculating it is to derive the expression of the eigenvector corresponding to the result plus plus, just take the EPR state, project on it, take the square, and you have the result. This is very fast, very efficient, you don't make any mistake, it works. The only problem is that I doubt that you can make an image out of that. I can't. And the reason why we cannot make an image out of that is that this calculation is made in a configuration space, in a space where you describe simultaneously the two particles. Okay, it's not a real space, it's not a three-dimensional space, a space where we meet. It's an abstract space. I just gave you an anecdote that I have read in Maxiana, so I think it is reliable. And it's more than an anecdote. At the beginning of quantum mechanics, so in the years 1920-something, 26, 27, people were trying to interpret the wave function, and Schrödinger tried extremely seriously to interpret it with a kind of hydrodynamic view, okay? You have a current of probability, etc., okay? And Schrödinger realized that when you want to apply quantum mechanics to two particles, not to a single particle, you cannot keep this view that it is just like a true current and something like that. Here you are facing the same problem. With this calculation, how can you make a picture, an image? No, this is an abstract calculation, okay? The reason, of course, is that it is a global two-particle wave vector. But I hope I can at least teach you that. Maybe you have already done this calculation. There is another way of doing the calculation. And I strongly encourage you to do it if you have not yet done it. For a while, you are going to decide that this polarizer is a little closer to the source than the other one. So you will make a first measurement here, and then a second measurement there. And now you can describe things in real space, okay? I first do a first measurement here, and then it will be there. So I try to make a picture in the real space. So what happens? There is first a measure here, we know that the probability to get plus one is 50%, and the probability to get minus one is 50%. So one of the two things may happen. So we can have plus one or minus one. What do I do then? If I am not sure, I go to a good book of quantum mechanics. I'm just insisting that what I'm going to do here is absolutely standard orthodox quantum mechanics. Okay, I'm not playing with that. I mean, I open coherent energy, I look at the postulates, and I find how to do the calculation. And what I found is the following. If I get result plus one, that is to say I get the result corresponding to a polarization on A, then immediately after this result, then the state vector, the initial state vector, is projected onto the eigenspace corresponding to this result. These words mean something clear for you? Okay. And the projector for this eigenspace, if I note plus A and minus A, the two eigenvectors corresponding to polarization parallel to A or perpendicular to A, the projector is just, sorry for that, the projector onto, it is an eigenspace in a two-dimensional space, okay? So the projector will be plus A X, plus A Y, plus A, Y. Okay, you can write it like that. So you write it like that, it's easy. You have your projector, you apply the projector here, and at the end of the calculation, what you find is that the new state vector is now a factorable state. It's a state where the first photon is in polarization along A, it's clear, I have found this result. So it's normal that I find it like that. But the second photon is also polarized along A. If you have not done this calculation, do it. Again, it's absolutely serious. Then the second step, now I have this state, I make a measurement of that polarizer, and of course, it's just the minus rho, and so the probability is cosine to the square of having A. But the probability of having result plus one was one half, which means that the joint probability to find plus plus in orientation A and B is one half of cosine to the square. So I recover the previous result, but now I have made the measurement in two steps that I can follow in real space. Of course, if I find result minus one here, and I play the game of looking what is the projector on the eigenstate corresponding to minus A, etc., what I find is that after the measurement that gives minus one, then the new state vector described in the pair is minus A, minus A. And I play the game, minus rho, etc., etc. And I recover the previous result. And of course, I have a picture, but the price to pay is very heavy. Because the picture that I get from this decomposed operation is the following. Photon U1 travels towards polarizer A. Until the last moment, nobody knows if you will get result plus one or if you will get result minus one. But then the mysterious measurement happens and you get plus one. Then immediately the photon which is far away takes polarization plus. But if the result of measurement is minus one, immediately the photon which is far away takes polarization minus. And this, of course, Einstein could not swallow. Because, of course, Einstein did not think that anything could travel faster than light. And here, there is no time of propagation for the measurement here and the fact that the other photon, which is far away, takes that polarization. So if you take seriously quantum mechanics, you apply the rules, and you try to derive an image from these rules, the image is totally crazy. And Einstein did not like it. By the way, what did Bohr answer to that? Bohr answered, don't try to make a change. Just calculate, and that's enough. No, if you look carefully, both say if you try to make an edge, you get into trouble. Okay. Of course, Einstein did not like it, and so the idea of Einstein was, can't we try a less bizarre image? Image. You understand my French accent. There is obviously a way to understand correlation at a distance. And this way is very simple. You can think that when the two photons are emitted, they assume a common property. And it is this common property that will decide the outcome of the measurement here and there. Okay? So this common property, as you know, you can call it lambda, etc. So I don't need to elaborate. This you understand clearly. Okay? If I have a joint property here, it's very easy to understand that I can have correlation. So this image is very simple, but makes four unhappy. Why? Because you are completing the formalism of quantum mechanics. Why do I say that you are completing? Well, it's very simple. In quantum mechanics, all the pairs are described as the same state vector. All the pairs are described by psi epr equal 1 over root 2 xx plus yy. Okay? But here, I pretend that there are certain pairs which have a property lambda. All the pairs have another property lambda prime. All the pairs have another property lambda double prime. So there are many different kinds of pairs. In quantum mechanics, there is only one type of pair. All the pairs have the same property. That's the effect. So as soon as you invoke supplementary parameter lambda, you are completing quantum mechanics. And we are at the equation of the EPR paper. So my reasoning here is slightly different from the reasoning of Einstein. It's more the reasoning of Bell. But the result is the same. To have an image which is not crazy, you say, I have to introduce a supplementary quantity lambda. And by doing so, you come to the conclusion that you complete quantum mechanics, and Bohr had realized that if you begin to complete quantum mechanics, you have other problems. Okay, so it was the end of the story between Einstein and Bohr, and unfortunately, they died before they found this beautiful result. So maybe I can speed up at the Bell theorem. You have seen it in detail. So I will speed up at this point. I will just say that what Bell does is that he takes seriously the ideas of Einstein. And so he says, let us introduce supplementary parameter lambda. And let us say that the result of measurement here will be defined by a quantity with value either plus 1 or minus 1, and this quantity depends on what? It depends on the property of the photon arriving here, depends on the orientation. And then the same on the other side, there is a certain function, b of lambda of b, which can assume only value plus 1 or minus 1. Okay? Of course, you must say how the supplementary parameters are distributed among pairs, and for that, you introduce a function which is defining positive. Okay? I'm sure you are aware that if you have a specific form for the function a, b, and rho of lambda, you can calculate any quantity. For instance, just to show it, p plus of a is what? The probability to get plus 1 here. So I introduce this quantity, which takes a value plus 1 when the result is here, and 0 when the result is here. The average of this quantity is nothing else that the probability to get plus one, okay, etc., etc. So if you have a well-defined form for that, you can calculate everything. And the most interesting part of it is that, in fact, the correlation coefficient, again, defined classically, for so this correlation coefficient can be easily expressed as the average of the product, capital R, capital V. Okay. So this you know. And before going further, do you know this naive example or not? Okay, I'm going to elaborate. We give an example of what could be a local hidden variable theorem. And the example is the following. When the pair of photons are emitted, we assume they are something that we call polarization. So they are common polarization. They go like that. This polarization is defined by the angle with a certain axis, let's say it's x axis, okay? We obviously want to have rotational invariance, so we take the distribution function for the angle equal 1 over 2pi, okay? So it's isotropically distributed. So there are pairs along with polarization along any direction, okay? Now, what I must do is to invent the famous function capital A and capital B. I will make a guess. This is what I like as a function. You will see that it makes sense. This function here, capital A, describing what happens here, is a function which is a sine of a certain quantity. So it has value either plus 1 or minus 1, because it is a sine. And look at this quantity here. You will discover that what happens is that if lambda, the polarization, is close to the measuring direction, then you get plus 1. And if it is orthogonal, you get minus 1. And the borderline is at 45 degrees. That's the simplest thing you can think of. OK, I say it again. The photon arrives with a certain polarization. If the polarization is along A, it's plus 1. If it is perpendicular to A, it's minus 1, and the bottom is the bisectrix. What can you do better? Okay, you will see that this model is awfully efficient. It's spectacular. With this model, you can first start to calculate P plus and P minus, and it was good for that. Obviously, you get the result 1/2. This is clear. More interesting. If you calculate the correlation coefficient with this model, you find plus 1 for parallel polarizer and total correlation, okay? Minus 1 for orthogonal polarization. Minus 1 means total correlation. The minus means that if you get plus 1 here, you are sure to get minus 1 on the other side, which is normal because you have crossed the polarizer, okay? So you find the same prediction of quantum mechanics. The model is very efficient. And so here, I have plotted, I hope it will work. Yes. So here, I remind you, is a prediction of quantum mechanics. Here is a model that I have just a very simple, very naive model. See, not bad. So of course, when you see that, you go and see your friend who knows everything about special function, you know, Bessel function and everything, you say, could you help me to find a better model, okay? To have the red curve fitting everywhere, the blue curve. And so, of course, you hope that it would be possible with a more sophisticated model to reproduce exactly the quantum mechanical prediction. And John Bell tells you, no, it's not possible. Even if you know all the special functions in the world, you will not be able to reproduce this. And of course, for this, I don't need to go into detail. You know how to derive Bell theorem. You know the easy demonstration. What is a demonstration? Who wants to tell me? How do you demonstrate Bell theorem? Okay, I tell you how I do it, and you stop me. I just want to demonstrate that if x prime, y, and y prime are four numbers with value either plus 1 or minus 1, then this quantity small s equal x, y, minus x, y prime, etc. You know that?
You know or you don't know?
Okay, so you know I can demonstrate it. Okay. So you know this quantity has a value either plus 2 or minus 2, and when you take the average of a quantity of a quantity which is either plus 2 or minus 2, the average is between plus 2 and minus 2. Okay? So you have to realize it was not always as clear how to demonstrate Bell's inequality. And of course, so you know that Bell's inequality is a fact that this quantity S between plus 2 and minus 2, and there is an example of orientation which violates the inequality. So because there is an example of violation, you are sure that there is no model which can reproduce the prediction of quantum mechanics with a set of actors. Okay? So now you have the conflict. And you have to realize strongly that this conflict was not clear for Einstein at all. When you read the papers of Einstein, you read the philosophical papers or the letters to Max Born or these things, it is clear that Einstein had the conviction that you could, on the one hand, keep the prediction of quantum mechanics, and on the second hand, on the other hand, complete quantum mechanics. Okay? So for Einstein, it was not clear at all that there was a conflict between completion of quantum mechanics with hidden variable and quantum mechanics. On the other hand, it's quite clear that Bohr had realized that if you complete quantum mechanics, then at some moment, the self-consistency of quantum mechanics will fall apart. But this is a problem with Bohr, that it was not clear at all how it was explained. And it is the beauty of Bell's theorem that it is crystal clear that if you try to complete quantum mechanics in this way, then quantum mechanics is no longer self-consistent. Okay? So, of course, you know this discussion, what are the hypotheses for Bell's inequalities, and that is to say to obtain a conflict with quantum mechanics. You know, of course, that first, well, I don't know how much you have heard of that, because 20 or 30 years ago there were a lot of discussion of that, now it's more or less clear. Of course, you want to introduce something like hidden variables, okay? So either you say, as I have done it here, I want to have an image for understanding the correlation. And the clear image that I have in my mind is joint probability. From the beginning, I call it lambda. Or you can make complicated reasoning. For instance, Despagna, if you have read the books of Despagna. There are papers of Despagna where Despagna makes some very general hypotheses about there is a physical reality, and he defines the physical reality as well as he can. And at the end of his reasoning, he introduces the lambda. That is to say, the lambda comes as a consequence of some general assumption of there exists a physical reality and something like that. So, what I like to say is that you need an hypothesis saying that you want to understand the correlation in a reasonable way by assuming joint properties of the two particles. Okay, you need something like that. And of course, there is a famous locality hypothesis that John Bell very clearly wrote in his first paper. I mean, this is really the discovery of there are two big discoveries of John Bell. The inequalities, but the fact that locality is crucial. So you know, of course, that the locality hypothesis is the fact that this capital A cannot depend on the orientation of the other horizon, and the fact that the density of probability rho of lambda described in the preparation of the pair here cannot depend on the orientation of the two sides. Okay? This clearly is written by Bell in his paper. And so we can say that Bell's inequalities hold for any local hidden variable theory. A local hidden variable theory. Hidden variable theory because I need a hidden variable to understand the correlation. Local because of this locality hypothesis. If you prefer, to come with initial, more general hypotheses like there is a physical reality, but you have to be careful how to define it, and then you will derive the existence of either variable. You can also, if you are Mr. Vespasian, you will say that Bell's inequalities hold for any local realistic or realist theory. Now, in the first paper of Bell, when I read it, it immediately struck me there was something very interesting about the locality condition. Bell was saying the locality condition appears, looks like a reasonable hypothesis. This hypothesis says what happens here does not depend on a norm that I term here. But what's going on in this paper is saying, after all, maybe there is an unknown new physical interaction which provides a dependence of this as a function of the orientation. Why not? There may be an unknown field, okay? And so Bell went on and said there is one way to eliminate this possibility. It is to rotate rapidly at a random, to change rapidly at a random the orientation of this one. Because then, when I do a measurement here, I cannot know what is the orientation of the other one because nothing can go faster than that. So, if I am able to change the orientation of this polarizer rapidly at random, then the locality condition is no longer a reasonable assumption. It's a consequence of Einstein's causality. So, the idea was change the orientation of the two polarizers rapidly and at random, and then the locality condition becomes a consequence of Einstein causality. And so at this point, you see that what you are going to test is really the worldview of Einstein against quantum mechanics. Because in such an experiment, what you have is that Bell's inequality derived totally from the worldviews of Einstein. First, I want to complete quantum mechanics to understand this correlation in a not crazy way. And second, the locality hypothesis necessary to derive Bell's inequality is a consequence of Einstein causality. Yes?
How can you rotate it rapidly, randomly, when, from the perspective of somebody who advocates a hidden variables theory, nothing is random?
Okay. This is an interesting question, and for this, I have a quite rude answer, which is the following. It's always possible to explain anything happening in the world by saying that God decided of that at the beginning, okay, at the time of the Big Bang. This is a good theory for explaining everything. I don't like that, okay? So I refuse to accept this point of view. So for me, there is at least the free will of a guy who will select the orientation of his polarizer. And if I do the experiment with a long enough distance, there is time enough to have a guy who decides at random, well, now I will choose this angle, now I choose another angle. And honestly, I think that if I do that with some random process like Gregor has done in his lab, you know, like going on a beam split or something like that, I think it's a good enough random process. But if you don't think that random process of this type are real random process, then I tell you, okay, do it with very long distance optical fibers and put a guy who chooses at will his orientation. And if you tell me there is no free will, okay, we don't have the same. Well, I'm no longer interested in my physics. You understand my point? Logically, you are perfectly right. But it should be clear that there is no point in doing physics if you can interpret anything by saying that it is written in the great book and everything was flat. You think real physics would be interesting? I don't think so. Do not either. So, I like to put Bell's theorem under this form, some prediction of quantum mechanics cannot be mimicked by a reasonable classical light model in the spirit of Einstein's ideas. And of course, the question, how does nature behave? When Bell's theorem appeared, there was no experimental result available for testing Bell's inequality versus quantum mechanics. You know that or not?
Yes.
You know everything. So what I am doing? What am I doing? So the question is, of course, couldn't it be that the violation of Bell's inequality indicates a limit of the validity of quantum mechanics? Or so you know that also?
Yeah.
Well, the first experiments were experiments with gamma photons produced in the annihilation of positronium. Okay? Positronium is an electron and an anti-electron. The mass is 0.5 mega electron volt. So they annihilate, you get two gamma photons with energy 0.5 mega electron volt. The problem is that there is no polarizer for gamma photons. There is nothing like a polarizer for gamma photons. What I call a polarizer is an apparatus with two output channels. You know how they measure polarization for gamma photons? You don't know.
Good.
I can teach you that. You have a target, and you send a gamma photon on the target, and it will be scattered in a certain direction of space. And it's not bivalued, okay? It can be in any direction of space. But you have a probability to go rather in this direction than in another direction as a function of the initial polarization. That's called contour scattering, and there is a so-called Kleinischna formula for that. Which means that if you observe the distribution of the impacts of the gamma photons, you don't have something like a plus one result or a minus one result. So you can say, fine, I take space and I split space in two and I decide plus one is here and minus one is here. If you do that and you do the quantum mechanical calculation for that, you find that the prediction of quantum mechanics does not violate Bell's inequality. So you cannot do a test like that. So what did the people do, which was the best thing they could do at that time? From the distribution of the impacts of the photon, they reconstruct the polarization of the photon, assuming that the relation between the initial polarization and the distribution of the impact is given by the quantum mechanical formula. They assume the Kleinischna formula to go back from the various results to the polarization, and to go back to the result of measurement that you would have if there would exist a polarizer for gamma photon. So what they found is agreement with quantum mechanics, but we cannot say that they did observe a violation of Bell's inequality. There was something like a circle, okay? But they did observe agreement with quantum mechanics. There was a beautiful experiment suffering the same problem, but it was with massive particles. It was done in a nuclear center in France, in Saclay, by Mittig and Lamy Rashti, 76, I think. It was with protons, and the proton has a spin, and they were measuring the spin of the proton, and again, they were not measuring it with a Stern-Egerlach. Stern-Egerlach doesn't work well at all for charged particles. Okay, Stern-Egerlach works for neutral particles, but not for charged particles, because the magnetic field acts on a traveling charge and you cannot observe anything. So in fact, for showing the spin of the protons, they were again using some scattering process and you have the same surface. Anyway, they found the result in agreement with quantum mechanics, but it was not a true test of Bell's inequality. The breakthrough came with this paper by Clauser, Horn, Shimony, and Holt in 1969. They demonstrated, you know how to demonstrate that. Do you know how to demonstrate it? That if you have a cascade like that with J equals 0, J equals 1, and J equals 0, you obtain that state of polarization. You know how to demonstrate it? Okay, I give you an idea. take the quantization axis along the propagation, okay, along the z axis. You take the quantization axis here. And I plot what happens for the cascade. Here, the state is j equals 0. It's not degenerate. In the intermediate state, j equals 1, you have 3 sublevel, m equals minus 1, 0, plus 1, and the final state is non-degenerate, is j equals 0. Put the atom here and let it decay. It can decay here, or here, or here, three possibilities. This doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because you cannot have, if the z axis is like that, the matrix element for coupling between the atom and the radiation field for this orientation is zero for this transition. This would be a pi transition. And a pi transition can be only perpendicular to the axis of quantization. Okay, a pi transition, if you want to have a, well, you have to go into books and look into selection rules, but to make the long story short, when you have a pi transition, you can understand the pi transition by saying it's just a classical oscillating dipole. And you know that the classical oscillating dipole will not emit along the axis, and it will emit perpendicular to axis. Now I've taken at the axis of quantization z here, which means that such a transition, which is a pi transition, can only emit photons in direction transverse to the axis, but not along this axis. So the only two channels that I can have are these two channels. So I can have either this photon, which is a polarization, sigma minus. You understand what means sigma minus? That means circular polarization with a certain sense of rotation. You know these notations or not? Be careful. You must not confuse sigma minus and sigma plus with right and left. Right and left is helicity, which means that right, when I travel this way, is like that. And right, when I travel this way, is like that. It turns the other side. Okay? When I talk of sigma plus and sigma minus, I take the axis z like that, and I say that if it turns like that, it's sigma plus. If it turns like that, it's sigma minus. It does not depend on the sense of travel. And when I plot things here, it's the sense of rotation. I'm not talking of helicity, I'm talking of sense of rotation of the polarization. So here, this is a sigma minus transition, and this is a sigma plus transition. Here is a sigma plus transition, here is a sigma minus transition. And so what do you have? You have an initial state, which is you have an initial state, which is the atom is in the state E. And if I just look two modes of the electromagnetic field, one mode corresponding to one photon like that, and one mode corresponding to one photon like that, is 0, 0, vacuum. And the final state that you will get here, you have two paths to go to the final state corresponding to the atom in the ground state. So you go to G. One photon in sigma plus, one photon in sigma minus, plus one photon plus G, one photon in sigma minus, and one photon in sigma plus. Because there is two ways to go from here to here. And of course, you can factor the G that you have here, and you are left for the radiation with one photon with polarization sigma plus going to the left, one photon with polarization going to the right, polarization sigma minus, plus one sigma minus, one sigma plus. And then you just have to use formulas like probably, I may make a mistake, but it's about one photon with polarization sigma plus, of course here I need one over two, okay, because I want to have a state which is normalized. Okay. And here, one photon with polarization sigma plus can be written as one photon with polarization x plus I one photon with polarization y. These are linear polarization divided by root 2. And if it was minus, it would be a minus sign here. So you plug that into it, crank it, and you find the state which is good. Okay? The key point is the following. There is two ways to go from here to there. Either I send photon sigma plus and photon sigma minus, or I send photon sigma minus and photon sigma plus. And because I cannot distinguish between the two probabilities, then the state that I get is a third of these two possibilities. It's clear? Okay. And now, when you do this kind of demonstration, you understand why the experiment is difficult. For instance, let's suppose that there is a straight magnetic field that lifts the degeneracy here. You know that if I have a magnetic field, then there is a Zeeman effect. Then the frequency of this photon is slightly different from this one. So I can distinguish between the two paths. So the system will not work that way. So that means, for instance, in your experiment, you want to be sure that the stray magnetic field is smaller than the value that would lift the degeneracy. Okay, et cetera, et cetera. There are plenty of considerations of this type. Well, this is what is written here. Any computable, well, if you have an hyperfine structure, then you have many paths, but this path goes through different levels. Again, you can distinguish the photon because of their energy. And so you don't have an entangled state, et cetera, et cetera. So you have many things that you have to take into account. And what is amazing, I don't think that anybody has done a demonstration for that. It would be interesting. I don't know any effect increasing the amount of the correlation. All the effects you can think of, you calculate them, they can only decrease the amount of correlation. I don't know any general theorem for saying that, but it's a matter of observation. So when you see all that, you think that the experiment must be as ideal as possible, because what happens if the experiment is not ideal? Well, if the experiment is not ideal, you do a quantum mechanical calculation for your non-ideal experiment, and the prediction of quantum mechanics is that it does not violate Bell's inequality. So there is no point in doing an experiment. Okay? So, first generation of experiments. It was an interesting fact. Clauser and Friedman in Berkeley in 72, working with calcium. You see, it's very important that you are sure what is the isotope. Because again, if it was a non-isotope, you would have a hyperfine structure in the intermediate state, and it would not work that way. So you must have a pure isotope. And the problem is that the excitation was very weak, and they had to accumulate data for hundreds of hours. And they needed, by the way they were doing the experiment, they needed to have the source with a strictly constant excitation. And you are not experimentalist. Maybe some of you are experimentalist. Okay, what you should know is that as soon as you want to make an experiment around the clock, it's very difficult because the temperature is not the same during the day or during the night. The sun comes and heats the south side of your building, and the building slightly tilts. You may not be aware of it, but the building tilts. When people want to redo the Michelson experiment, they have this big problem, because you know the Michelson experiment, you are looking for an effect which changes over 24 hours. But what they observe is the fact that their interferometer slightly tilts like that because the building tilts because of heat and things like that. And so it's just to say that doing an experiment of more than 10 hours is extremely difficult. because many things can change.
Okay.
So no big surprise that the other experiment that was done in an experiment which is supposed to be not too bad, okay, these experiments gave a conflicting result. This result was in agreement with quantum mechanics. This one did agree with Bell's equations. Okay. None of these experiments was using laser to excite the atoms. It was like electron bombardment or broad spectrum discharge lamps, etc. Then Fry and Thompson in Texas, 76, came with an experiment in which they were exciting the mercury atom with a laser. And you see immediately, rather than accumulating for hundreds of hours, then you can perform an experiment in about 1 hour, something like that. So it totally changes life, okay? They found the results in agreement with quantum mechanics. Anyway, all these experiments were single channel experiments. You know what it means, single channel experiment? I don't know if I have it. No, yes. Single channel experiments with an experiment like that. It is an experiment. You know or you don't know the reasoning for that? It is an experiment in which you have the result plus one, but the result minus one is blocked, just like a Polaroid. You know, a Polaroid transmits one polarization, blocks the other one. And of course, when you see that, you say, well, what do I do with a minus result? And then, of course, theorists are smart people. If you ask a theorist and you tell him, I'm really annoyed because I would like to do an EPR type experiment, and I just have polarizer with plus one channel. What should I do? And the theorist says, it's very simple. If you have something, it's plus one. If you have nothing, it's minus one. Looks ridiculous, but in fact it works. Why? Why does it work? Because you can do an experiment in which you remove a polarizer. And so if you remove a polarizer, you easily admit that it is a sum of the plus one and minus one result. So if you compare with polarizer, you are plus one, you remove the polarizer, you have the sum of plus one or minus one, you can easily imagine that you can deduce the minus one result for that. But there is a problem. The problem is that you must be sure that the source is absolutely stable when you remove the polarizer. This was the difficulty of these experiments. They were always single channel polarizer, and they had to do experiments with both polarizer, experiments with one polarizer removed, and experiments with two polarizer removed. And the experiment has a meaning only if the source has a perfectly constant intensity, perfectly constant rate of delivery of the photons. Okay, let's come back to the point where we were. So here, these were all these experiments with one channel polarizer. Okay. Now, the real breakthrough, I am not going to bore you, to annoy you with experimental details, but this was a real breakthrough. It took us more than 3 years to build this source. This cascade of calcium had been recognized by John Clauser as a very good candidate. But at the time of Clauser, the excitation was very poor. The idea is the following. You know a little bit of atomic levels. So in calcium, you have the ground state, which is here. Then you have, so these are so-called S states, that is to say state with J equals zero. Okay? Now you have S state like that. Okay? Then you have P state, that is to say state with J equal one. And the idea was, if I can put the atom here, you know that there are strong selection rules for dipole, for electric dipole emission, and this strict selection rule tell you that you have to change parity of the state. So these are even states. The only thing you can do is go to an odd state and then to the even state, and this is the cascade you want. The problem is, how do I get here? I cannot excite it with ultraviolet light because this doesn't change parity. Okay? So the trick they were using was having a broad lamp, and they were exciting P levels up here. And from there, many things can happen. Sometimes you are lucky, you go here, and then you get the two photons you want. But most often, you are going to a D state here, you come back to this P state, and you go here. So, in other words, quite often you have photon you do, but you don't have the photon you want, etc. And the yield of the source is very weak, etc., etc. The real breakthrough was here. People had invented in that year what is called two-photon excitation. It's a nonlinear process in which you can add up two photons, and if the sum of the energy of the two photons is exactly resonant on the upper level, you have a decent probability to excite the atom. But the good news is the following. Even if the probability to excite is not very deep, if I put the atom here, then there is only one way to de-excite, and the only way to de-excite is to deliver the cascade you want to have. So it's a source delivering absolutely purely entangled pairs of photons. So this was really the beauty of this source. And with this source, just to make a long story short, we could obtain a signal of more than 100 coincidences per second. Which means in 100 seconds, you get 10 to the 4th coincidence. And if you have enough of idea of statistics, you know that if I have 10 to the 4th heaven, the statistical spread is root of the number of events. That is to say, the accuracy was 1% in only 100 seconds of experiment. And it's very easy to keep an experiment stable for 100 seconds. Okay? So that was the idea. The second point is the following. Here we have laser concentrated on a very narrow zone, a few tens of microns, something like 20 or 30 microns, I don't know how much to waste it. 50 microns in one direction, 500 microns in the other direction. And when you have a very small source, the optics that you have behind is much less complicated than when you start with a big source. And in the experiment of Klaus and all these other people, they were not using lasers, so they are big source. Because to have a decent amount of effect, you need to have a big source. So with these two features, our source was absolutely fantastic. So this just to impress you. The important point here, there are many important points. First, there are two lasers to do the two-photon interaction. But more important is the following. Here, you have the source. There is a vacuum chamber. Here, the photographer is 6 meters from the source, and there is a polarizer here. And there is another polarizer at the bottom of the other side, which means that the experiment was designed to have one detection far away, 6 meters. The other detection, 6 meters on the other side. Okay? Okay, so what we did was first to redo the experiment with one channel polarizer. We found an excellent agreement with quantum mechanics and a violation of Bell's inequality by Lange standard deviation by the Bell's inequality taking into account the fact that you can derive the minus result by experiment. There was something new in this experiment. And this something I think is very interesting if you think of interpretation. There was in the literature a so-called Fury hypothesis. And the Fury hypothesis is the following. When people began to think to this equation that Einstein was raising, some people say, look, maybe this crazy EPR state will exist inside the atom of helium. Or, you know, there are two electrons. Maybe it will exist on the macroscopic scale. But as soon as you will go far away, entanglement will disappear. In other words, you will move from, well, it's no longer here, you will move from a pure state to a mixture, to a density matrix, one half for the XX and the Y1. Some people saying, well, at macroscopic distance, entanglement cannot survive. And so, if you ask the question, what is the characteristic distance for, well, they didn't know, so they say, well, maybe it's a current length associated with the photon. And if you take the intermediate state of the cascade here, the lifetime is 5 nanoseconds, which means the length of the wave packet is 1.5 meters. and the distance between source and detector was 6 meters. So we were already at a distance larger than the coherence length of the photon U2, and entanglement was surviving because we did observe violation of Bell's inequality. So this was a real new result of this experiment, a part of the fact that the experiment was spectacular because of the rate of production of cascade. But then we began to do experiment closer to the ideal scheme. So we could build, and at that time it was really, now you can buy it on the shelf, but at that time it did not exist, so we need to have them developed by Philips in Holland, etc., etc. Finally, we could get polarizer with really +1 and -1 polarizers. And you see the beauty of this experiment is the following. You can have, and I will stop at this point. I come again now, first, okay? Here, you can have one detector here, one detector here, one here, and a four-fold coincidence electronic. This four-fold coincidence electronic registers simultaneously the events +++, -±, and -. So in other words, you will count for 100 seconds. At the end of this 100 seconds, you have four numbers. How many joints +++ and +++? How many +/- events, +/-, etc. You just take these four numbers and look at this quantity, and you have the correlation coefficient. No need to extra calibration. It's a self-calibrating experiment. You understand the idea? Because this is the total number of events that you have detected. So this divided by the total number of events is the probability to have +++. So in fact, you have P++ -P++ -P++ +P±. So you just do, and you don't have to say, I have to compare what I measure now with the reference that I measure later. It's a single run, and it's self-calibrating. This is a big change. So you will not be surprised to find that we found a spectacular violation of Bell's inequality. First, we were able to test the original Bell-type inequality, that is to say an inequality where you compare a quantity to two. So you see here, you violate Bell's inequality by more than 40 standard deviations, okay, which is really impressive. And I will stop here, but what I want to show here is the following. We did measurements for many sets of arbors. And the quantity S that you measure here, the results are the red blocks that you see here. And what we plot here is ±1 standard deviation. And the green curve, believe it or not, but you have to believe, the green curve was calculated before doing the experiment. What is the green curve? The green curve is a prediction of quantum mechanics taking into account the slight inefficiency of the experiment. Before doing the experiment, we had measured the quality of the polarizer, and we knew that rather than transmitting 100% of the good polarization channel +1, it was only sending, I don't know, the number I've written like this, okay, something like 98%. And rather than sending 0% of this polarization in channel -1, it was sending 1 or 2%. So we have measured that beforehand, calibrated everything, and from that, you can calculate the prediction of quantum mechanics taking into account this slight inefficiency. So you see that the curve here doesn't start from 2, but it's slightly below 2. Doesn't go to 2, that would be 2.8, goes to 2.7. And you see that the result of the measurement were absolutely exactly on that curve. I must say that when I saw that, I was really impressed. And I hope that you are impressed also. And we will stop at this point, and I can answer questions. And before you ask me questions, I want to ask you a question. What do you expect from me next time?
The little point you have.
Okay, but this will not last 1 hour and a half, okay? So what else? No, I mean, the choice is the following. Well, of course, I will finish that and take my time, and it will take, and I will, do you know how to demonstrate that you cannot use entanglement to send faster than light messages? You know that? Okay, I have nothing to teach for
someone who knows.
You don't know? So, okay, I will do that. And then the program by Joseph Emerson was to talk about the loophole, the efficiency loophole. So I want to talk a little bit about the efficiency loophole, but I must say that personally I'm not so excited by that loophole. So I would prefer offer you the following thing. You know, this year is 2005, year of physics. So I prepared several general talks of quantum mechanics, and I have a talk about the first quantum revolution, about wave-particle duality for a single photon. Would you like to have 30 minutes of talk on that? Okay. So I have my program for the next time. So now you can, so this is what I will do the next time. Finish that, a little bit of efficiency loophole, and then I will explain you wave-particle duality for a single photon, which is also something interesting for quantum mechanics. Now, anybody who wants to ask questions, go ahead. I'm not lying. Because I went through it. I'm not that. Yes?
Your two photon laser for your experiment, so that allows you to get by the selection rules, basically?
Say it again?
The laser you use for your experiment, like the two photon laser, it lets you to get by the selection rules of the system. Is that what you want?
Well, here we begin to be technical. You have to understand that because the upper level is non-degenerate, it doesn't matter how you excite the level. Okay? It's a matter. Here, J equals zero is the ground state, and J equals zero is the upper state. This state is non-degenerate. So you don't care how you put the atom in that state. As soon as you are able to put the atom in that state, then you are sure to have the two paths for going down and to have your entangled state. So the exciting with laser is convenient. But if I had, I could dream of a world, an ideal world, where I can concentrate a pencil of electrons with an energy so well defined that I can exactly excite the atom from here to there with electrons, it would be exactly the same. The only problem is that with electrons, I cannot have a selection good enough in energy, and I cannot concentrate it in a zone so small as with my lasers. But it's a matter of convenience, the fact that I excite with the laser. The important thing is I want to put the atoms here.
If you allow it to go from near the ground to the
end. Ah, okay, now I understand the equation. Sorry, I missed your question. The question is, why am I able to go from here to there directly? Because it's two photons. It's the product of two odd operators. The product of two odd operators gives an even operator. This is even. This is even. And I have a matrix element with a matrix element. The matrix element from going from here to there is a product of two matrix elements. One is on, the other one is on. The result is different. Sorry, I have not understood your question.
Yeah. To expand on that, we still have it absorbing two photons, and it seems like it absorbs two photons at the same time because it's got no place grab one photon, go up,
yes.
Stop in between.
Yes.
So how does that work?
Okay, this is interesting. You should have a lecture on non-linear optics. The idea, it's a very good question. The idea, and you will see that physics is really beautiful. I hope to convince you. You know that. Excellent question. The idea of a two-photon transition is the following. here you have a real state, this ground, this relay, and this excite. Okay? And what you do, you come with a frequency which is strongly off resonance, and here you design, you draw it like so-called virtual layer. And what happens is that you have the effect of energy delta E. So you can spend here the time, okay, which is delta T of the order of H bar divided by delta E. Okay? If the intensity of the second laser is large enough, then there is a probability that one photon can come and bring it up during that time. And now, what is the probability that the total event happens? It's a product of the probability that the first event happened, and this is proportional to I1, the intensity of the first laser. And the probability that the photon arrives during that time is proportional to I2, the intensity of the second laser. So the probability is a product of the two intensities. It's a nonlinear process. It's a product of the two intensities. Physics is beautiful.
You use a laser in theory that is exactly the same?
Sure, absolutely. Many people advise me to do it that way. But in fact, this really technology. The point is the following. The laser that would have allowed me to do that was a laser in the blue-violet. And at that time, it was awful dye lasers. And we know nowadays that they were even more awful than we think, because these dyes were extremely toxic. And people didn't know that. No, I'm not joking. People have gotten some cancers by it. But I did not know that. But what I knew is that using this dye laser was terrible. And what I had krypton ion laser allowing me to go here, and then to match the difference in energy here, I had the most efficient dye laser in the world that was called rhodamine 6J, and it was known that it was a dye laser easy to work. Okay, so I prefer to have two lasers. It looks more difficult, but it was easier because you need one fixed laser and one tunable laser to be exactly resonant. Okay? And it turned out that it was easier to add a fixed laser plus a tunable, easy to tune, rather than trying to be in the middle. So, yeah.
If that first laser was actually exciting it to that first excited state, wouldn't you then have a lot of problems with the noise?
Oh yes, of course you don't. Of course you don't want the door to be resonant.
So this process is kind of to get it to work this way depends upon having that first laser be
off resonance, yes.
Close to the resonance but not on the resonance.
Yes, exactly. And if you want to be a little more technical, the idea is that you again I drew it. The idea, if you consider the density matrix for this three level, what you do is that you build coherence between here and here. You build the coherence between here and here. You know what is the coherence, non-diagonal density matrix elements, okay? But you never build a population here. That's the trick, okay? If you were building a population here, then you would have a decay. But you can just, you look at the optical block equations, etc., and you find that you can build the coherence here, so non-diagonal density, but no population here. You know what is population, I mean, it's a matrix element row of RR, if R is that set. This equals zero, but row of GE is different from zero, and row of E GR is different from zero, and rho of R, E, is different from zero. And by recoupling this product, and then from that you go to rho E, E, different from zero. So that means you were able to build the population here. nonlinear effects are subtle. I was lucky because the two photon absorption was demonstrated simultaneously in this country by Ted Ench and Mark Levinson, but in Paris by Bernard Cagnac and Gilbert Grandet, and so they were my friends, so they explained me all that, so I could immediately use it. Yes.
Is that done in pulse then, or CW?
CW. CW. That's the beauty of correlation function. If you think at the probability of detecting photon mu1 and photon mu2, the probability of detecting photon mu1 is steady state, it's CW. Probability of detecting photon mu2 is CW. But the joint probability of detecting photon mu2 with a delay t after mu1 is the standard curve. Like that, okay? Tau is a delay between detection of the first photon and the second. You cannot detect the second photon before the first. So here it's zero, suddenly it rises in decay, and here it's 5 nanoseconds. So single probability has CW, but the joint probability has is strongly peaked. And this is remarkable because this allows you to extract the signal from any noise. Because in the noise, you never have signals like that. So you very easily extract your signal.
Any more questions? Well, that's thank you.
I'm afraid I was a little too slow.
No.
No.
No.